What if everything we think we know about mental illness is a social construct? Michel Foucault's Madness and Civilization isn't just a history, it's a radical reimagining of how Western society has defined sanity by creating its opposite. In medieval Europe, madness occupied a strange, almost sacred position. The mad weren't simply sick, they were vessels of mysterious truth, celebrated in Shakespeare's Insightful Fools and Bosch's fantastical paintings. Towns would expel their madmen on ships of fools, creating a curious traffic in the insane. These ritual embarkations reflected a deep imaginary relationship between water and madness, purifying while carrying away. The madman became the ultimate passenger, with truth and homeland only in the expanse between places that could never belong to him. Why did madness fascinate Renaissance culture? Because it represented the world's dizzying unreason while speaking truth in simpleton's language. The madman's laugh anticipated death's laugh, disarming it. These grotesque figures revealed secrets of our own nature, the beast set free, acquiring a fantastic nature that stalks humanity and reveals its truth. The fool, in his innocence, possessed intact the difficult, hermetic knowledge that the man of reason sees only in fragments. In the 17th century, Foucault's Great Confinement radically altered society's approach to madness. Within months, over 1% of Paris's population was confined in massive institutions. For 150 years, the mad were imprisoned alongside the poor, unemployed, and criminals, not for treatment, but moral correction. This reorganization stemmed from a moral shift where sloth replaced avarice as the cardinal sin. These institutions merged state and moral laws into one bourgeois ideal. Work served as both spiritual exercise and punishment, with moral discipline prioritized over productivity. While most forms of unreason were hidden away, madness received unique treatment. It was publicly exhibited. In Paris and London, viewing lunatics became Sunday entertainment, with keepers forcing madmen to perform tricks for paying visitors. This exhibition fundamentally differed from Renaissance freedom. Madness was now displayed behind bars as something alien to humanity. The classical age had effectively silenced the voices that the Renaissance had once liberated. The classical age viewed madness not as disease, but as man's zero degree of nature, animal freedom unleashed. Folk wisdom described how the insane could survive extreme conditions, a perception that justified harsh treatment. The response was discipline and brutality to restore man from his animal state. Monasteries subjected violent madmen to strict regimens, 10 strokes for disobedience, rewards for submission. A Scottish farmer named Gregory became famous for curing insanity through forced labor and beatings. Unlike modern deterministic views, classical thought saw madness as unforeseeable freedom, where frenzy was unchained. The mad belonged to an abstract bestiary, where evil held intimidating power. Paradoxically, in Christian theology, madness gained demonstrative power. Christ himself chose to be surrounded by lunatics, even appearing as a madman. Dicebant quinyamen in ferorum versus est. This sanctified madness as the ultimate form of God in man's image before the cross, simultaneously blessed and cursed. The classical age saw madness as intrinsically linked to passion, that intersection where body meets soul, activity meets passivity. Passion wasn't merely madness's cause, but its fundamental possibility, creating a shared domain between physical and spiritual. When passionate movement either stops suddenly or reaches extreme intensity, it can suspend normal laws. Violent emotions trigger madness much as impact generates movement. Imagination alone doesn't constitute madness. One might imagine being dead without being mad. Madness emerges only when imagination is accepted as truth. Within this capturing image, madness becomes discourse, both sustaining and eroding the image itself. The madman's reasoning follows precise logic, the syllogism, the dead don't eat, I am dead, therefore I don't eat, or the induction of the persecuted. Madness represents language's hidden perfection, reason enveloped in the image's prestige. By the 18th century, melancholia and mania emerged as the primary forms of madness. Melancholia involved delirious self-perception while maintaining otherwise rational thought. Thomas Willis described it as madness without fever or frenzy, accompanied by fear and sadness. Melancholic spirits were characterized as heavy, shadowy, and opaque, like acid vapors. Mania developed as melancholia's opposite, featuring perpetual flux of thoughts rather than fixation, and audacity instead of sadness. Willis attributed it to violent movement of animal spirits, creating explosive gestures and continuous words. The maniac's world was parched and brittle, contrasting with melancholia's humidity. Willis discovered the internal relation between these conditions. Aggravated melancholy could become frenzy. Diminished frenzy could turn to melancholy. He illustrated this through smoke and flame. Melancholy was vapor obscuring the brain, while mania was the ignition of these vapors. By the late 18th century, the manic depressive cycle was recognized as unified, with James's dictionary noting that melancholics easily become maniacal, and when the mania ceases, the melancholia begins again. The celebrated images of psychiatry's birth, Tuke's countryside retreat, and Pinel's liberation of chained madmen have become legendary. Yet beneath these myths lay operations that silently structured the asylum world. Rather than liberation, Tuke's retreat functioned as an instrument of moral segregation, with Quakers isolating their insane members from corrupting influences. Fear became essential in the asylum, not external terror, but an internalized fear serving as mediation between reason and unreason. This internalized fear had disalienating power, subjecting madness to morality. Work stood central to the moral treatment, engaging patients in a system of responsibilities through production demands. Tuke valued the need for esteem, organizing formal tea parties where patients competed in politeness. These weren't dialogues, but occasions where the madman was positioned to see himself through reason's eyes. Pinel's asylum similarly imposed bourgeois morality. Silence became a powerful therapeutic tool. When Pinel freed a delusional former priest who believed himself Christ, he ordered complete silence toward him. Without an audience, this prohibition proved more effective than physical restraint. The physician's power to cure originated from moral order, with patients already alienated within the doctor-patient relationship. By the 19th century, psychiatrists no longer understood their inherited authority. The doctor became a thaumaturge whose power appeared self-derived, an objectivity that was actually a reification of a magical nature requiring patient complicity. The doctor-patient couple became the concrete reality containing all alienations, explaining why 19th century psychiatry converges on Freud. While dismantling asylum structures, Freud elevated the doctor's powers to quasi-divine status. Foucault reveals that madness now forms the constitutive moment of abolition for art. Yet through this absence, these works speak to the modern world. Our world must now justify itself before the madness of Nietzsche, Van Gogh, and Artaud. In this reversal, we find ourselves judged by madness rather than judging it, confronting our rationality's arbitrary nature. Perhaps the line between sanity and madness is social rather than medical, and our treatment of the mad reveals society's fears more than healing. By understanding madness as a mirror, we might finally see ourselves in those we've silenced.